good, Frank. Thank you for participating. Craig, KD2OGB, you're up next. What's your question or comment for tonight?
First thing is first, KD2OGB, first thing is first. This question is, I need to know on this. For Windows 10, you have Pro or Home?
Craig, you're dropping in and out of the repeater. If there's any way you can strengthen your signal, please try.
Windows 10, do you have Home or Premium?
I have Pro.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear. So, I have, I think I have Home Premium, if not, I don't know what I have. The hard drives that I have, all my external and internals, how do you put a password on them without external software? Because I don't have BitLocker on mine.
Well, I mean, that's the problem. It depends on how easy you want to do it. The easiest approach, most people would say, is BitLocker, but without Pro, you don't have BitLocker. What I would suggest, let's see, what program is it that I use with regularity? Nice and quiet. VeraCrypt, I believe it's called. Yes, VeraCrypt. I use VeraCrypt. I like it a great deal. It is the successor to TrueCrypt. The people who were handling TrueCrypt either decided that they couldn't be bothered anymore or felt that it was not secure enough and so gave up on it. But I would suggest VeraCrypt. It's capable of encrypting a file directory. You can pretty much turn an entire drive into an encrypted one. You can do all kinds of interesting things. You could have hidden encryptions within encryptions so that you have a carrier with a simple password, but if you use a different password, it opens up a small portion within, hidden with even more secret stuff. So it's a fun little program to play with, VeraCrypt.
Okay, now here's another problem. What I want to do this on is a Wi-Fi hard drive, basically a wireless one, because as you know, when I go out taking pictures, I save everything to an SD card. What I want to do is basically wirelessly transfer everything to the Wi-Fi hard drive, but I want it password protected because I'm thinking about people snooping around my stuff, and then basically be able to access the storage from my computer without having to, like, plug anything in or whatever. So, like, transfer everything on the go, and then I literally just have it already on my computer, even though I'm at, like, New Hyde Park or something.
I'm not 100% sure that I'm getting this. When you're talking about an external Wi-Fi storage device, are you talking about cloud, or are you talking about an external hard drive in your shack that, rather than connected to an Ethernet cable for some reason, is connected through Wi-Fi? I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to.
Basically, a Wi-Fi hard drive that your phone can hook up to, and basically just transfer everything that way. That's what I want. The router, but I don't know if I can do that away from home. I just want it to be an external wireless hard disk.
Okay, well, like I said before, the simplest solution I could think of that costs you nothing is something like VeraCrypt. In the same way, when you link the Wi-Fi hard drive partition to your computer, you can then configure a fake drive that is the decrypted version of the hard drive that's running on the Wi-Fi connection. And using passwords and such, you can encrypt the hard drive. If you lose your Wi-Fi hard drive, it's meaningless to these people. They can't decrypt it. Only through the decryption key on another computer can you decrypt the information.
But the thing is, what if I want... Like, I have to move everything from an SD card. Gee, I wonder how long that would take.
Okay, unfortunately, you're dropping out of the repeater about 50% of the time, so it's difficult for me to kind of reconstruct what you actually say. The problem might be, and I'm just kind of guessing at it, that you're wondering how to shuttle in a quick way data back and forth from your Wi-Fi hard drive into your laptop. I mean, it depends on how secure you want everything to be. If you want everything to be semi-ridiculously secure, you would set up an internal encrypted partition in your laptop, and you would shuttle the data back and forth between your encrypted partition of the Wi-Fi into your laptop. It will inevitably slow the process down a little bit because it has to decrypt and encrypt. Thankfully, the encryption algorithms, and you can select which one you like, are relatively robust and not that slow. A good central processing unit will suffice for the most part. The basic key is a much tougher algorithm that takes longer time for it to come out with a hash code. But once it has that hash code, it uses the hash code and a simpler algorithm to encrypt and decrypt.
Here's the harder question. Would it be faster if I did this with the Wi-Fi hard drive with me, or with it back in the house? Basically have to do it from like 100 miles away.
Well, it depends on your internet connection. If you have a very, very good internet connection, you won't have a bottleneck. Most people inevitably do have a bottleneck, and so most likely you'll get the fastest throughput by having the Wi-Fi hard drive in your location as opposed to remotely.
Okay, so basically I would have to carry it with me and do everything quickly rather than just at my workstation.
Unless you happen to have a very good internet service provider, you can run time codes, speed tests, and see what your read-write rates are for different situations and adjust your behavior accordingly.
I'm getting a little tired here. Okay, I could do that. But I'm going to have to try to figure this out, considering how I want everything to be quick, but at the same time, I don't really want to carry it around with me and potentially damage it or have someone swipe it. I just want to be able to quickly send everything over, and all I have to do is just go back home and then basically just transfer everything from that Wi-Fi drive to the computer as if it were already there when I'm, like, not even at home.
Okay, once again, if you happen to have a good internet connection where that won't be a significant bottleneck, you might be able to configure your system accordingly. You won't kind of know until you test it out.
I'll have to give it a try. I believe that is everything I have. Thank you very much for your answers, Roy. And with that being said, AC2GS, net control, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good, Craig. Thank you for participating tonight. I hope it works out for you. If you want to come back at some later point and tell us how it went and what you figured out and whether or not you like VeriCrypt, then please do.
Let me tell you, you've become way smarter than Dick. For that, I really thank you very much. KD2OGB.
You're welcome, Craig. Next on our list for tonight is Rich, W2BZ. What's your question for tonight, Rich?
The computer version of the TechNet. First of all, about security. Whenever I think about security, it's gunning for me. For me, with all the problems in the world, me. And if they are coming after me, they have to have some pretty sophisticated tools to intercept my data and get what they want. Nobody's coming after me. And if somebody was coming after me, it would be a neighbor who doesn't know what they're doing anyway. That's what I think about security. Anyway, to upgrade from Windows 10 to Windows 11, your computer has to be capable of something called TPM 2.0, which means you already have TPM 1.2 on it. And those are security algorithms. They're coming out now with it's software now, but motherboards are starting to come out with TPM chips on the motherboard. And so I went to see if my computer, my Windows 10 computer, was capable of putting Windows 11 on it. And let me just drop a second. Came back and said that my computer, one computer, was capable of it, and my laptop did not have a processor that could handle Windows 11, even though the laptop is only like 2 years old. Anyway, so I started installing Windows 11, and it came up with your computer does not have TPM on it. So I go on the, Google is your friend, and I went on Google, and I saw a couple of workarounds that I didn't like, and then I saw a couple of regedits that looked okay, looked safe enough to try. And I tried them, and both of them did not work. And what those did was have the computer bypass checking to see if you had TPM installed on your computer. I'll drop one more time. So, workaround that they know of, and it's not illegal. Microsoft is, I read, is even coming out with a workaround for it eventually, because there's no reason, if somebody wants to put Windows 11 on their computer and you have a legit version of Windows 10, they should be able to. Even Microsoft acknowledges that. So, but does anybody now have any kind of workaround for putting Windows 11 on a Windows 10 computer that does not have TPM on the Windows 10 computer? That's the question, Lori.
Okay. I mean, again, the short version is probably going to be, as far as I'm aware, not yet, but as you mentioned, Microsoft sort of promised that they would have something, but there were a lot of questions of whether they would be upgradable over time and when upgrades would sort of fail for them. But for overview, let me just generally explain to the audience who may not be aware of what Rich was talking about. Windows 11 was semi-released October 5th. What that really meant was that prior to that, people on the Insider program could download beta and release candidates. But October 5th really meant that they started to sell new PCs with Windows 11. And they're going to slowly allow people who go to their update to window to update to Windows 11. It's going to be a slow rollout, they say, that may go into the middle of 2022. So it's going to be a real long-winded rollout. One of the problems is that they're requiring a lot more security with Windows 11 and with the computers run them than they did with Windows 10. This includes something called Trusted Platform Module Technology, TPM 2.0. For the most part, some computers come with 2.0. Other computers come with an opening where you can put a TPM 2.0 module in the motherboard. So it is theoretically possible, even if you do not have 2.0, that it can be upgraded. You have to check your motherboard and a manufacturer and figure that out. There's another little trick. A lot of times the TPM 2.0 is not activated in the BIOS, and so the computer is not terribly aware of it. In those cases, you should look at your BIOS settings and see if there are instructions on how to enable PPM 2.0. In addition, you also are required to have something called boots. Unfortunately, screws up more than a few amateur radio operators who have questionable drivers for a lot of their equipment. So with Boot Secure, sometimes those drivers will fail and you'll have problems handshaking with COM port, serial port adapters. So that's Boot Secure. Also, as Rich mentioned, let me drop for a second. As Rich mentioned, there are limitations in the chips. Certain chips it will not accept. They have to be within the last few years in certain classes, both AMD and Intel, and if they're not in that group, then the initial installation will fail. As Rich mentioned, Microsoft heard a lot of people yelling and screaming when people found out, and so they made some kind of vague promise that at some point there will be some way of installing Windows 11 onto old machines with some unknown limitation. As far as I'm aware, and I'll open it to the general public, legitimate solutions that don't kind of act very wonky are not yet available for people who do not have a TPM 2.0 chip in their motherboard. But if anyone has any knowledge of any crack that's a legitimate, decent one, and not something that's really broken beyond belief, please hit that push-to-talk button.
WB2KWC, this conversation makes me very nervous.
Why, Ken?
Okay, well, a software author has come out and said, here is my piece of software, here are the requirements for the piece of software, and here we are just saying, I don't meet the requirements of the software, I'm going to install it. I don't know what the future updates to this piece of software are. I don't know if those requirements are going to become critical, but I want it anyhow. So the question I pose is, what is so critical? What feature in Windows 7 is so critical that you would risk installing it on a non-supported system? AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Okay, that is an excellent question, Ken, and something I have been asked and asked and talked about. You know, what does Windows 11 really bring to the table? Not really that much, in my humble opinion. And yet, a lot of people, probably including myself, will dip their toe in the water. I've checked all three of my computers. They all three tell me that they're ready and willing to accept Windows 11. They have a TM 2.0 chip and everything necessary. But just as a curiosity, now I did the same thing with Windows 8. I took one of my Windows 7 computers, I upgraded them to 8. I played around with it for about 4 days, got completely disgusted, downgraded it back to 7, and kept it that way until they came up with 10, and then I repeated.
Comment, KD2UQK.
Yes, please, feel free.
All right, fellas, this is Rob, KD2UQK in Deer Park, New York. I overheard the Windows 11 discussion. I actually do IT professionally, so I've been toying with the idea of loading up a Windows 11 machine. So I actually tried it at work. I used the crack around, the crack, and I got it to install on a computer. So as far as I'm aware, when I did mine, Microsoft, if you go around their system requirements and don't install it correctly, you know, if you don't have the TPM module, they don't provide you with Windows updates. So if you have that on a computer, it won't even update. So, I mean, unless they change that spec in some regard, I don't think it's even worth doing. There was some kind of bulletin that they put out that Windows 11 was going to be used for newer machines that had the hardware and stopped for all the legacy machines. If they didn't have the 2.0 TPM 2.0 module, the stop would be Windows 10. There's really no point going past it. I don't really see a need to install Windows 11 on any legacy machine, in my personal opinion.
Okay, very good. Rob, I appreciate your insight. You're the professional here. Yeah, I kind of heard the same thing, although, you know, Microsoft is infamous for changing its mind. You know, these are the same guys who told us that Windows 10 was going to be the last in the series. It would not be an 11, 12, or 13. It's very possible that 3 or 6 months from now, they'll tell people that, you know what we told you about PPM 2.0? Well, we changed our mind. Everything is subject to change. But again, other than curiosity, I don't really know of a great benefit. I still have a lot of my Windows 10 configured to sort of look like Windows 7. I use a product called Start 10, which simulates the start menu of 7. And I already installed Start 11 that's capable of doing that with 10 and 11. And so it'll be a little experiment. It'll be an experimental process just out of curiosity's sake. I don't expect to benefit from 11 as opposed to 10, but I'm curious.
See any great benefit between 7 and 10? Do you, Roy?
It's a little bit flatter. It requires a little bit less graphic acceleration. There's less glass and transparency and all kinds of doodads that aren't really necessary. So I thought 10 was inherently a cleaner design and as stable as 7. I just like things to be in the same place. So that's why I use Start 10 and Start 11, just so that when I go to the Start menu, I mean, because I hate those live tiles. And apparently everyone else hates those live tiles because, guess what? Windows 11 does away with the live tiles.
Ken, to answer, let me see if I have it a second. To answer your question, why would anybody take a chance in upgrading something that they say is not upgradable? The answer is stupidity.
Good answer, and I am probably guilty of the same stupidity or curiosity or whatever you want to call it.
I did have a real reason, though, and that is I have some quirky network issues on my Windows 10 machine, and I thought maybe and corrected by an upgrade to Windows 11. And that's the only reason I would have done it, because of my some stuff that I don't like the speed of on Windows 10. That's all.
I personally have never noticed a significant uptake in working speed when layering on top an upgrade. Going back to the base metal and installing from brand new, yes, I've noticed improvements often. But when you start to put an extra layer of coat of paint over your Windows 7 with 8 and 8 with 10 and 10 with 11, I think there's still a lot of detritus left behind.
It's probably very true also. So that adds stupidity on top of stupidity.
We're all fallible human beings here, unless you know something to the difference.
You know, we're all ham radio operators, so that means we're all tinkerers, especially when it comes to electronic stuff. When I got into ham radio, there was no such thing as home computers and regular big-time computers. Big IBM computers were just coming online in business. So it's just about that innate thing that we all have to try to get the better and the best and the newest and the fastest and the coolest.
Not necessarily. I've told you stories. 10 years ago, I still recall guys who were very proud that they did not have a computer in their shack and they did not see a purpose in having a computer in their shack. And they were incredibly proud about that nonsense. So, unfortunately, it confused the heck out of me when I first got into this hobby. I thought everyone was sort of like me, a technophile, but not necessarily. There are people who love radios and, for some reason, hate computers.
No who doesn't have a computer.
Oh, I don't know of anyone,
I should say, who does not have a computer. Does anybody know of who's under the age of 90? Let me put it that way.
Well, I'll leave it open to the audience to tell me. I haven't heard similar conversations the last few years, so either they retired and moved on one way or the other, or something changed. But there were a lot of them. Then you started to hear people say, well, I have one, but I just use it to log my conversation or to do email with my grandchildren or something. So little by little, it's kind of bled into amateur radios. Operators of all ages, but 10 years ago, it was a large contingent of guys who were just proud to be back there at 1905, 72, whatever. Okay, so I think we covered this, Rich, right? So we can move on to poor Ed, who's been sitting on the sides waiting for his time.
Give me one second.
Okay, WB2EAD, am I doing okay now, Roy?
Yes, you sound great.
All right, a little background. I think it was 3 weeks ago, somebody asked if anybody might be able to discuss something about aircraft, radio, communications, and navigation. I said I'd be glad to take that up. And I haven't been able to make the last few nets, and I told Roy that I can continue right now, and I was thinking, unless somebody has a better idea, maybe I'll give a little description of how one aircraft navigation system, VOR, works. It does resemble a lot of stuff that will be familiar to hams. Roy?
Yeah, sure. I'm sure other people would like to hear it. I would like to hear it.
Actually, the best way, I'm sure most of the guys listening are familiar with Doppler scan receivers that will tell you what direction a signal is coming from. Well, a VOR is actually a Doppler scan receiver run backwards that an airplane tells what direction signal is coming from. Same way, but it originates with the transmitter. So what they do is they have a ground station that has a series of antennas. It has one central antenna. Well, let's start with a Doppler scan. What you do is you have a batch of antennas in a circle, and you rapidly switch one antenna after another to the receiver, stimulating a mechanically rotating antenna. And when the antenna is rotating away from a signal, you get a drop in frequency, Doppler effect. When it's rotating towards, you get an increase, and when it's going sideways, you get a null. And what happens is, you get a kind of piecewise sine wave that is at the rate of rotation, which in some systems I've worked on is 216 hertz, 216 rotations per second. But the key point is the phase is determinant of the angle of which it's arriving. Whereas with a VOR aircraft system, the beauty is the complex antenna is on the ground and the airplane just has a simple, you know, vertical antenna like you have on an HD. And let me drop. What they do on the ground is they have a single fixed antenna and a rotating circular antenna which consists of 48 antennas that are switched rapidly so that the signal is transmitted in effect a simulated rotating antenna that rotates 30 times a second. And there's a second one, like I said, and they're all at the same VHF frequency between 108 and 118 megahertz, and it's channelized. So a pilot looking at his map, which nowadays is on the iPad strapped to his thigh in the plane, see where a VOR station is. He tunes his navigation receiver, which is very similar to his communications receiver, to that frequency, and both stations transmit at a very close frequency, possibly the same frequency. I haven't been able to figure out, but the bottom line is the single one transmits literally a PL tone at 30 hertz, just like the 136.5 hertz PL on this repeater, but it's a 30 hertz PL tone, and the antenna, the rotating array of antennas in a circle rotates at the same 30 times per second. What happens is, keeper in the plane sees both of them, and then it compares the Doppler effect, like I said, when the antenna on the ground is moving away from you, things drop in frequency. When it's moving towards you, things increase in frequency, and modulate that, and you get a 30 hertz sine wave. And then from the other antenna, get the other 30 hertz sine wave, and you compare the two, and much like in a DF receiver, phase between the two tells you the direction from which receiving the signal. So you get the same as a Doppler scan receiver, but with a really fancy antenna, but it's not on the plane, it's on the ground. Roy, how are we doing so far?
Doing good, Ed.
So what a pilot does is he tunes his to the VOR station, and he'll see, okay, the VOR is due west of him, so he knows, like 270 degrees, so he knows it's on that line. Then what he can do is find another VOR, and there's probably about 10 of them on Long Island. So he'll switch to a nearby VOR at a different angle, get the bearing for that one, and where the two lines cross, that's exactly where he is. Now keep in mind, this is primarily recreational aviation, not airlines. Let me drop it. When you're flying in an airliner, it is all completely ground control, particularly if, if you're domestic, if you're not crossing the ocean. They are watching you every step of the way, and they are telling you what to do. They will tell you to take off, turn right to a particular heading, climb to a particular altitude, and then they give you a frequency for the next controller, and you just switch from controller to controller until you're on the ground at your destination. VOR is primarily for recreational pilots flying around, and with the advent of GPS, kind of used as an addition, it's a little bit backed up, because now planes have been moving more and more towards GPS. So if you are landing at a small airport, you have your options. You have a visual approach. You have a GPS approach. You have a VOR approach. Well, any or all of these will work, and there's also an instrument landing system approach, which the airliners do use. Why do you think that's enough? Do you want to ILS, or we're running out of time?
No, we have a little bit more time if you want to do ILS.
What ILS does is it sends a beam up into space, line with the runway at a 3-degree glide slope, is where most planes like to approach a runway, coming at 3 degrees until you're just about to touch down. So it's the same idea, again using a PL. But what they do is they have two transmitters on the same frequency, but with very, very sharp antenna beams pointed in slightly different directions. And what you do is you have one of them pointing a little to one side of the runway center, the other one pointing a little other side of center line, and they're the exact same frequency, so you don't get a beat note. They do have different PLs, and the receiver decodes the two PLs. It's normally 90 hertz and 150 hertz. Let me drop. And the way the antenna patterns are set up, so that if you're coming right down the center of the runway, you are kind of between the beams. They're both, say, 6 dB down, and the 90 hertz PL and the 150 hertz PL are decoded in the receiver, and their amplitudes are compared. And if you write down the center line, they're both a little bit 6 dB down from where they would be at their peak, but they're equal. And all the equipment cares is the relative amplitudes, not absolute. And there's a indicator that has a line, that when you're on the center line, there's a little pin that's straight up and down, and as you go off, it moves to the right or left. Now what happens is, you go a little bit off, either the 90 or the 150 becomes another one, and the pin starts to go off, the needle moves off, it tells you you're a little off center line, and you correct to bring it back on. Again, both of these antenna patterns are very narrow. Like I said, they are both fall down a little bit right on the center line. Of course, they have the peak. So maybe at like 3 degrees off, maybe you're getting the strongest signal on one and pretty weak on the other one. And once you go there, then they just start to fade off and eventually disappear. But the key point is, it doesn't respond unless you're getting both of them and the relative difference fits within a certain profile. Roy?
Yeah, very good. Looks like I'm going to have to go to Wikipedia and kind of give myself a little lesson. Some pictures probably will help me kind of flesh it all out. But that's very good, Ed. I appreciate it.
All right. Let me repeat. Now, that's azimuth. Elevation works the same way, but the center line, 3 degrees above, horizontal, and it's on a different channel, but everything else is the same. It's just turned on its side. Roy?
Yeah. Anything else?
Well, I think we're running out of time, so maybe I should quit while I'm ahead.
Okay, very good. I do appreciate you giving us this little talk. It's been educational, and like I said, I'm going to probably take a look at Wikipedia. They probably have some pretty pictures to demonstrate some of the things that you mentioned. So I do appreciate your help here, Ed.
Just be warned, this is a little bit of an oversimplification, particularly with the ILS modulation scheme. I've oversimplified a little to keep it nice and short and understandable. I went to Wikipedia to check it out, and it was really quite confusing.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of times pictures kind of help in our understanding, and it's one of those things that I don't have available for people on the radio here. So, the old line that one picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah, but I'm warning you, ILS in particular, there is a classic way of teaching ILS, which is basically what I just said. They said that's not 100% right, and there are pictures, and there's a little footnote saying the picture isn't actually completely correct, see text. And I went into the text, I don't know if it was me, I don't know if it was them, I saw what they were trying to get, but I couldn't quite wrap my mind around it.
Okay, so it's a challenge. I don't know if I'm quite up to that challenge, but I'll try and kind of suss it out or take a look. There's a lot of things we sort of take for granted because in order for the average person who doesn't have multiple degrees, you kind of want to keep it simple. So you simplify it, and that's always a compromise. The more you simplify a subject, the less accurate the description is. Taken to its extreme, you end up telling people fairy tales that make them feel very good, that they've walked away from an explanation that they can totally wrap their heads around perfectly, and yet it's completely facetious. I mean, even great geniuses like Stephen Hawking pulled that nonsense in one of his books, where he describes how Hawking's radiation works in a way that has nothing to do with physics, as anyone, including him, knows it. So, I live in fear of too much simplification in scientific terms. I understand why it's necessary, though.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention again that YouTube video has some nice pictures of what it's describing there on the Doppler VOR. That YouTube video, the technical wizardry of VOR is how they work. It has some very nice pictures that illustrate that Doppler effect that he was just describing.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I did post it on my link page. If you go to the September 26th portion of the link page, it's the third link, not third link, it's the second link down. The technical wizardry of VOR is how they work. So I thank you very much for giving me that link. Okay, anyone else with any comments on this subject? Once again, I thank you, Ed, a great deal. I appreciate you bringing your knowledge and sharing it with us.
You're quite welcome.
Number two, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, Zulu Charlie.
Quick question. I was, I'm going to be moving to Florida, and my plan was to stream you guys down there. So I just tried it now. Is the link down? Is that a link that I see not functional, or am I missing something?
My guess would be that you're using the link that's on LimeWire's webpage, are you?
Yes.
Well, that's where you go wrong. Why would you expect LimeWire to give you a link that's particularly useful? They have a link to the Long Island streaming service. I don't know where their antenna is. I could probably violate my FCC license by suggesting where it might be. That is not the place to stream it. I give you two options if you are interested. If you simply want to stream the audio and you don't want to get onto the repeater, then you can listen to my stream, which is at technet.ac2gs.com. I try to keep it on 24/7, and it's much higher quality than the static and nonsense from that other person. If, on the other hand, you want to chat with people, then you could always use the Echo link. It's live a lot of times. There are people who use it with great regularity.
Very good, very good. Can you just give me that the address to your link again? I got technet at...
Yes, it's technet at my call sign, which is alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Roy.
You're welcome, John. You know, I used to do that only during the technical nets. I already stream another club's repeater, and I just turned it towards W2VL because of the technical net. I thought more people would be interested. And a gentleman out there who's a who is a software listener used to listen to the repeater. He never had a call sign. He never had a license, but he liked to listen to the LimeWire repeater when he was living in Long Island. He moved to the Carolinas, and he wondered if I could keep it going for, you know, the rest of the week. And sure enough, he listens all through the week. So, you know, that's why it's the way it is. I've asked the people at LimeWire if they want to mention my link as opposed to the one that's very noisy, and apparently they don't really want to. But, okay.
Yeah, why would they want to do that? All right, Roy, thank you very much again.
You're welcome, John. You know, I try and break my rules. I should have a T-shirt that says no good deed goes unpunished. But I don't know. Just make this one guy down in the Carolinas a little bit happier. All it takes is a little programming and not much computer resources. So I'm glad to help him out down there. Anyway, this has been loads of fun. I do have a puzzle, but it's already 10:18, so maybe I'll keep it in my back pocket, and we'll return to it next Sunday, something to look forward to. So I just want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I had a great time. I hope you had a great time. I hope you learned a few things. And I just want to quickly re-mention the link. If you want to reach me via email, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. The TechNet streaming The Limark Glen Oak streaming is technet.ac2gs.com. And always like to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. That's his site, amateurradio.tv. It's already had a million visitors. So keep that in mind. The wisdom of Dick K2RIW and Eric and great, wonderful people who shared all their wisdom with us that we missed. So thanks to everyone. I'll be back a little bit later, but it's time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet Report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good. And if anybody wanted to email me directly, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. So you can do that one. You could add that to your list, Roy. Okay, first thing I wanted to talk about is this launch that's coming up on the 10th. Correction, the 16th. The Lucy launch. Lucy is a spacecraft that's going to be going out to the orbit, really the orbit of Jupiter mission. It'll be there, and well, for the first time it'll get to that orbit would be 2025. And the idea is to investigate all these different asteroids that are located there, you know, in the same orbit of Jupiter, but ahead of it. And then there's another group behind Jupiter. They lead Jupiter. That would be the L. And then another group behind it. These are millions, either in front of it or behind it. Right, five. So in other words, if you draw an equilateral and then in front of Jupiter and the Trojan asteroids are located. We've never been up there to investigate it yet. And they know the names of the ones that they plan on looking at. In different groups. So the idea is to circle the Earth twice, grab it, and eventually that will be, you know, fast enough all the way of the orbit, which is almost 500 million miles. So, you know, I think it's 460 million miles away or something like that from the sun. Spacecraft is, see a picture of it on Dr. Roy's website, as well as the path that this thing's going to be taking, reaching from Earth this Saturday, orbiting the Earth twice, and that would slingshot Jupiter by 2025, actually, before it gets there, they want to run a test on the actual asteroid belt Mars. And that's their first test on all their equipment. It's going to pass he's the guy that Lucy, you know, an anthropologist years ago, in the 1970s, you know, dug up Lucy, and they found out that was the oldest fossilized human that they could possibly find. I think it was 4 million years old or something. Anyway, they found out so much from that they decided to name this mission Lucy at all. Also, you know, Lucy's going to investigate these untouched asteroids from the beginning of the solar system. So they know they're, you know, pure in state, and they'll have a good idea of what everything really looked like before it started to coalesce into planets. So the scientists are looking forward to that, and they're sending this large spacecraft, I think it's around 4,000 or 5,000 pounds out to Jupiter. The spacecraft has an ion engine, which is getting more and more popular nowadays. to help with our, you know, go through these extremely long missions. And you can really, gain some speed with it as well. Also, it has these big solar panels to supply the electricity that's needed for the ion engines. Ion engines really don't need oxygen, gas at all. Ion, they'll take the xenon gas and ionize that, and where magnetic coupling or static electricity, they're able to accelerate this stuff, hundreds of thousands of miles an hour. The xenon goes flying out the back, and that's how they're able to move. But they need power, and they need large solar rays. These are going to be the largest solar rays ever flown at that distance. From what I understand, it's supposed to be more square footage than the Juno spacecraft presently in orbit around Jupiter. Anyway, they've got these two round solar panels that are going to open up. They're made by a company in Germany. The NASA has them make these things up. And the diameter is going to be like 24 feet. So, when it's in orbit around Earth, we're able to pick up over 10,000 watts of power. So you give you an idea how long it is. So figure out the square footage of these two 24-foot diameter solar panels. Roughly that's what you would, it would turn out to be. I think it's something like, in Earth orbit, it's around 15, a little bit more than 15 watts per square foot. So anyway, it comes out to over 10,000 watts of power. But because of the inverse square law, by the time it gets all the way out to Jupiter, which is like 20 times further, and that's when, it's 5 times further, but inverse square law gives you 20 times the, divided by the amount of wattage. So you're dropping from 10,000 or 11,000 watts down to around 500 watts. So when it's out in Jupiter area, it will be producing only around 500 watts. So anyway, it'll investigate the first group, and then it'll continue on. It won't be orbiting. They'll do flybys. They'll first do the Donald Johanson one in the asteroid belt, and then it'll continue on to the Trojan asteroids near the Jupiter orbit. And that first group will be 2025. And then it'll swing around Earth again, just keep on going. The Earth will pull it back, but then it'll accelerate again, and then it'll fly out to the other group, the lagging Trojans. And that'll be many years later, around 2032. And it'll investigate a couple of interesting asteroids out there as well. By that time, the mission would be over, but like all these space missions, they always have extended missions. Because of this stable orbit that it's in, it'll keep going, past Earth and then back out to the orbit of Jupiter and over again. It can happen literally thousands of times, or even, a million years later. If Lucy is not disturbed, this thing will still be going, passing the same group of asteroids every now and then. So I thought I'd bring that up. Any questions about Lucy? This is WS2N. Okay, well, it should be interesting to watch that thing take off anyway. We'll look for that on Saturday, I think it's Saturday morning. So, okay, here's a story that, of course, the news media has really picked up on. And I don't really see that much science value whatsoever in this topic. But William Shatner, who used to play Captain Kirk, of course, on Star Trek, at 90 years old is going to get a shot to actually make it into space, suborbital space. And Jeff Bezos got him signed up to do that.
do that on the new Shepard launch vehicle. That's the same one a couple of months ago that Jeff Bezos himself and an 82-year-old woman and an 18-year-old guy from the Netherlands, they all went up on that spacecraft for a suborbital flight. Booster comes back, lands back. This all takes place in southwestern Texas, or you know, far western Texas, out near El Paso somewhere. And that's where his launch complex is, and testing these things. This will be the 18th flight of a new Shepard vehicle. The last one that went up was unmanned. He ran some tests for NASA and some private companies. But now this one will be manned, just like two flights ago when Bezos went up. Anyway, we'll see how William Shatner does on this flight. At 90 years old, he'll be the oldest person to actually make it to space. Only around 4 minutes of weightlessness, and like I said, the booster lands back where it came from, down in Texas, and the capsule separates from that booster. It's not a two-stage booster, it's just one stage. Okay. It's got one, they call it a BE-3 engine, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and I think it's around 70,000 pounds of thrust or so. So you're gonna have somebody that played an astronaut for many years actually becoming one. The only thing I don't really like about this particular spacecraft, the new Shepard, is they don't have spacesuits. They get in and they go up without a spacesuit. They have these massive windows, half a dozen of these gigantic windows. You know, and I worry about a potential leak. It's not like an airplane. You know, I know Ed would be able to talk about this more, but you know, you go to a certain altitude in an airplane, and if you have a breach in the cabin, you know, people would have oxygen masks come out. But at least you'd have some kind of pressure. In a spacecraft, if you lose pressure, you're subjected to a vacuum. Maybe they have oxygen masks, I don't know, on board these things, but that's not good enough. You would need a pressure suit. You know, your blood is going to literally boil over if you're unpressurized. You know, that just won't work. Now, Richard Branson's Spaceship 2 on Virgin Galactic, it's the same thing. They're going up without any spacesuit. You know, if you look at pictures of them, that's it. SpaceX has it right. I mean, they just sent up there four people that were not astronauts. It's the first time that they've done that. They went on a three-day mission on the Inspiration 4 mission, and they had spacesuits. So, if they sprung a leak on the way up or on the way down, which is where the major problem is, they have spacesuits. Or if they detected one, in orbit during those 3 days, at least they could have quickly got into their spacesuits and been safe for a return trip. Not so much with the suborbital flights. I don't get why they're letting them do that, unless I'm missing something. So, let me drop it, see if anybody has any comments.
WB2EAV.
Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, I heard you refer to me, so I couldn't keep my mouth shut. If you're flying on an airliner and it loses pressure, not that big a deal, particularly if you do have oxygen to breathe. I mean, in World War II, they flew the bombers that were totally unpressurized at those altitudes where they were just using oxygen masks for hours. But when you're in space, it's totally different. At an altitude of 63,000 feet, boiling point of water is 98.6 Fahrenheit, which means your blood will boil. So in space, if you have a depressurization, an oxygen mask will not be enough.
Okay, so it sounds like you may get over. If you're 10 miles and above, you're in serious trouble then. I think you said 50,000 feet. A little noisy on that, but it sounds like you said 50,000.
63,000, 9 times 7.
I'm still not getting it, I'm sorry. 6, 3, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 3?
Yes, absolutely correct. 63,000 feet. 63,000.
Okay, I'll put that in my memory bank. Okay, thanks again. Okay, there's another company. It's a New York company. I haven't found out where they're located. My guess is their main office is probably in Manhattan. But it's a company called Rocket Star. And they plan on launching this fall. I don't have a date yet, but sometime this fall. I mean, before December. They want to launch it's a new type of rocket. They've experimented, or when I say they, NASA has experimented with the type of rocket engine in the past. This company is actually going to try to launch this thing on a suborbital flight, eventually an orbital flight. It's called an aerospike rocket. It's powered by an aerospike system. Should be interesting. So they can use, it doesn't really matter what kind of fuel, in this case I believe it's RP-1, kerosene, liquid oxygen. But, you can do it with liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, if you like. But it's the design of the engine that's different. We're used to looking at this big nozzle coming out of these, boosters. You look at the first booster as it takes off, like Saturn V, at five nozzles. Some engines, like the Atlas V, you look at it, it has two nozzles, but it's really one engine. It's just forcing combustion into two different nozzles. Anyway, the first, it's just this bell-shaped thing, and you gas, and you're expanding gas. The idea is to push it out as straight as possible. Really don't want gas to be shooting out on the side or something. Newton's law states that, equal and opposite reaction, and they're not getting exactly opposite is the best. So everybody has this bell shape to force the gas as straight as possible in the opposite direction of the rocket. So that's why when you go to a second stage, you get up to a higher height, and the first stage separates, and next thing you know, you have this second stage firing. But if you look at the shape of that nozzle, that bell-shaped nozzle is sometimes about seven times bigger than the other one, and you say, well, why do they need that? Why do they have that? And the idea is that when you get up to these higher heights, like Ed said, 63,000 feet, you have no pressure on the sides of the vehicle. So the if you keep running the same size bell as you launched with, instead of having a bigger bell on a second engine, the gas would start, start going out to the side, on 40, 50, 60 degree angles away from the direction of travel. You don't want that. You want it to keep going straight down, opposite of the rocket. So that's why in your standard vacuum rockets, for instance, SpaceX calls their Merlin back. Their Merlin vacuum engine. It's the same engine, exact same engine that they use on the Falcon 9, the 9 engines that take off for SpaceX. Well, they use the exact same engine on the second engine, on the second stage. But the only difference is this big shaped nozzle. And that's to make sure that the gas, the expanding gas is going as straight as possible down. Well, wouldn't it be good if you could eliminate that whole system? You'd be able to, just have one one stage, lift the rocket off, and go all the way into space and come back down. You would save a lot. You wouldn't need the complications of the second stage, you know, separation. You'd have more room for fuel. You wouldn't need an interstage and so on. The electronics behind the separation and the complexities involved. You wouldn't need all that. So the idea is to build this aerospike engine. Aerospike, they have two different types. One's called a linear and the other one's a toroidal shape. Anyway, the idea is if you take, let's say, if you separate, cut the nozzle in half, and you only have a half a nozzle on one side, and you just leave the other side open to atmosphere. When you launch with a rocket like that, you're still getting the force in the upward direction, but because of the atmosphere, high pressure, 14.7 pounds square inch down here, that's enough pressure to keep the exhaust on the open side, going in a downward direction. So you really don't need something on that side, just there more or less in the middle. And then if you shape it toroidally, in a toroidal shape, the circular type of system, you would have the middle, or would be this metal piece, and the whole outside would have nothing that would resemble a bell at all, nothing there. But yet it would work just fine at atmospheric pressure. And then when it gets further up into the atmosphere, and you start getting lower and lower pressure, the higher you go up, you wouldn't need anything to control that. It's eliminating that whole step. Anyway, Aerospike is trying to do this. Maybe one of these days I'll send a diagram over to Dr. Roy's page. A couple of them I've seen before that seem pretty good, that describe what I'm trying to explain. But if this works, and they can do a suborbital flight, this company RocketSaw, I think it will be a big advantage in the long run. NASA fooled with this stuff years ago. I mean, this is a amount of thrust NASA was trying to do. They were up to like 400,000 pounds of thrust. This is probably 60,000 pounds or so of thrust. But NASA had worked on it. They developed, one called a linear aerospike engine. So just one long setup and multiple. And they poured a lot of money into it. It was called the X-33. And that was going to lead to a bigger one called the aerospike engines. And the goal was to launch directly from Earth and go to orbit. This all took place before the shuttle's design. When the shuttle was being built, instead of the RS-25 engines that they used, each one produced probably 500,000 pounds of thrust, and they had three on board the shuttle. They had plans on using aerospike engines, but they found them too complex. They found them very hard to keep the set the metal part cool. They ran into complications with that. And eventually they just dropped the whole idea entirely. But nowadays, private companies are able to make quick adjustments and changes because they have the money to do it. And they don't have to go to Congress to say, okay, we're going to make a completely different change in our engine design or something. Like SpaceX. SpaceX thinks nothing of blowing up rocket after rocket. They say if NASA did that sort of interview with
with Charlie Golden. He used to be what's his last name? I'll think of it anyway. He was the NASA administrator. Bolden, Charlie Bolden. Said if we blew up a rocket, you know, like SpaceX did, even once. SpaceX has blown up like, you know, the Starship ones that he's working on now, like five of them. He says if we blew up one in NASA, Congress would have cut off funds. So this company anyway is going to try to develop this aerospike engine, which should be interesting if they ever get it to work and then eventually wind up with an orbital rocket. I hope it works out. It's an interesting design, but they have some technical challenges that they have to overcome. Any questions? WS2N.
WB2BXO.
WB2BXO. Good evening, Frank. Over to you.
Yeah, I thought Jeff Bezos should send up Nichelle Nichols along with Shatner to reenact the famous space kiss from the original series. What do you think of that idea?
Yeah, well, I tell you, this type of thing is going to make the news, and that would make the news as well. And you know, it was the first interracial kiss or something on TV, so they hop. You know, she got involved with flying a couple of flights on the 747. They call it the Sophia missions. Sophia mission is, it's a 747. They have a telescope sticking out of the back of the, out of the side of the plane looking up. And it's got a roughly an 8 diameter lens, very similar to a space telescope, except it's in an airplane. And she was on that flight quite a few times. She got involved helping out and almost becoming part of the crew for a while. That was quite a few years ago. And of course, she made some commercials for NASA. She did trying to get people interested in NASA and getting more astronauts to sign up, that type of thing. Right now, she's I don't know if it's Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia. Well, unfortunately, she's had some problems recently. But there you go, Frank. I don't know who's left. I think Sulu is left. I don't know what happened to the Russian fella. I don't know what happened to him. I know Coy is gone. The engineer, Scottish engineer, Scotty, he's gone. Anything else, Frank? Back to you.
Yeah, I can't remember the fellow's name off the top of my head. The guy who played Chekhov. If I remember correctly, he was killed in a freak accident in his driveway. Got out of his SUV and clutch somehow engaged in the... the vehicle crushed him, if I remember the story correctly. I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong on that. That is sad. I do not remember, maybe I vaguely remember hearing that about Nichelle Nichols, but I'm glad she got the opportunity to participate in the Sophia missions. That's interesting. Probably more worthwhile than being... recruiting poster girl for NASA, so I can certainly understand why NASA asked her to do that. Go ahead, Paul. WB2BXO.
Okay, very good. I had one of these conventions out in Stony Brook years ago. You know, people from the science fiction world and show up and, you know, they sign then autographs and books, whatever they have. And, I was out there, and I met Sulu for a split second. But talked to him for a split second, going up the stairs with him. Somebody I knew was involved with that show. That's how that happened. But I see him once in a while on TV. Make some comments. Even during these last year with these private missions going up, he'll get on TV and you know, say a few words to the commentators. Another mission, if you want to talk about private money, the Russians got involved with this one. This is the, they launched mission MS-19 last week, went up on Tuesday on the 5th, and it went up in the morning, and took around 4 hours, 3 or 4 hours, to dock with the International Space Station. So on board, they had a cosmonaut, commander. They also had an actress and a director go up. They plan on making a film on board the space station, well, part of the film. The rest of the film will be done on Earth. So, you know, they sent this group up, like I said, three people. The actress, you know, they competed on Earth on which actress was going to do it. Apparently this one won, and she went up, Julia Perisset, and then the director is Klim Shevchenko, and the astronaut is Anton Shkalaparo, I think his name is. And anyway, they've successfully docked with the International Space Station. And I get to see them dock, and then an hour or so later, they finally open up the hatch, and they floated in. With that, they floated in. You know, they docked to the RASPET module. The RASPET module is one of the Russian modules. Floated in and went into the Zvezda module. That's a large Russian module. Anytime a new crew arrives, if it's a Russian crew, they always have an immediate news conference right after they dock and get on board. You know, usually a half hour later or so, they have a news conference. I got to see that, this time with now 10 people on board the International Space Station. And, you know, if they have a Dragon dock with a crew, they always dock to the Hominy module on the American side. And they do the same thing. They'll come in there and they'll have a news conference, usually in a Hominy module for right at the docking with who's ever up there. So they showed, in this case, the 10 people on board, Americans, and there's a fellow from the European Space Agency, from France, another guy from JAXA, from the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency. He's on board, and they showed them all. And of course, they interviewed the three new people that just arrived. Amanda, the director of this movie, and the actress. Well, what was pretty cool of the Russians that I liked is one of the persons that congratulated the actress for getting there, the first woman ever to actually go into space, the Russian Valentina Tereshchukova. She was, you know, apparently at Baikonur, they had a link to, anyway, she got to ask, make a comment, ask a question, how you doing, that type of thing. And so that's pretty good. And anyway, this movie is going to be called Challenge. The idea is what they're doing is they're saying, well, a cosmonaut has some kind of a heart problem in space. That's the premise of this movie. So they need to send a doctor up to the space station. So they're going to send this actress up. So she's supposed to be a doctor, and she's going to operate on this guy, I don't know if it's open heart surgery or what they're going to do, but he's supposedly going to be operated on. And the idea is, he's the commander of the Soyuz vehicle. They need him to fly this spacecraft back safely to Earth. So they send another crew up, and why didn't just send another astronaut up? I guess the idea is this guy's got a heart problem, and if he doesn't get operated on, he won't be able to survive reentry. That's pretty much what I've been able to figure out. Anyway, if you're in Russia, it's going to be called a bizarre, which is Russian for a challenge. They're making this full-blown movie. Only probably a half hour or more will be actually done on the space station. At some point, they're going to go into the cupola. They need to do some scenes in the cupola. The cupola is the part of the space station attached to the Tranquility node facing toward Earth. You can actually fly two people in there at one time. There's all kinds of windows. Right above you, there's a 1 meter diameter window. And then there's, as you look in all directions off to the side,
they
have six other windows. And they're all trapezoidal in shape. They all have covers, and the covers can be closed if there's media problems, or if they're going to fire thrusters on a nearby arriving or departing vehicle, just in case it was closed. They will sometimes close those hatches for, But they'll make some scenes in there, and then that'll be it, I guess. Probably be able to eventually watch this movie with subtitles or something. Any comments or questions? WS2N.
WB2BXO.
Yes, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I think there's no date on it yet. I think Tom Cruise is going to go up with his director at some point to shoot some scenes also. So our guys are not going to be outdone on the movies in real space bit, I guess. No, I'm guessing that's going to be Top Gun 3, but I don't know. I guess.
Okay, copy that. Yeah, he was supposed to go up, and I think you're right. Eventually, he will go up and then do it, but they made an announcement that he was planning on doing it, and film crew with him. We'll see what happens if he goes up on Dragon. Do that. They say that when that was in the works, the Russians went into a mad panic. Oh no, we got to do this before them. That's the from the rumor mill. I don't know if I believe any of it, but or do I care really? But that's what happened there. So we'll look forward to seeing if Tom Cruise ever makes it to the space station. If not him, somebody else. Anyway, temporarily, for 3 minutes anyway, or 4 minutes, we'll have two actors in space at the same time. You'll have Podobi, she'll be up there with the Russians, and Piridiv, I think it is. And anyway, you're going to have her, and for the 4 minutes, you'll have William Shatner. He'll be flying up in the suborbital flight. He said there was a comment that he made. He says when he looks out the window, he just hopes that another gremlin won't be looking back in. And anybody who's old enough realizes that he made that one movie for The Twilight Zone. The gremlin on the wing, he's flying along, and he was the actor that portrayed that black and white. That's how far back that is, how young he was. He's flying along, and he looks out on and he's the only one that sees this thing ripping apart, on the wing, ripping it apart. So, and I've probably seen that a dozen times over the years. Any other comments, questions? The Starliner is still in bad shape. They're still looking that thing over. That's the one being built by Boeing. Made it to the launch complex in 2019. In December, it took off. It had all kinds of computer problems, timing problems with the computers, misfiring of engines unnecessarily because of the computers, running out of fuel. And eventually, the Starliner came back and landed.